Committee on Public Safety, Finance, and Policy to order. There is a quorum present. We do need to get approval of our minutes from March 7th. Sorry, that is today. From March 2nd, 2023. Does anybody want to move those? Representative Kern?
So moved, Chair.
All right. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are approved. Members, we do have several bills up, but before we do that, we're going to have our first of the budget presentations here from Post Board. Director Mislett is back, and so if you want to come on forward, Director, introduce yourself again, and then members, we will have time for questions after the presentation. Welcome.
Good morning, Chair Mueller and members of the committee. My name is Eric Nisselt. I'm the Executive Director for the Minnesota Peace Officer Standards and Training Board, known as POST Board. I will do a brief presentation regarding the budget. And then with me also is Rebecca Gaspard, who is our Rules and Legislative Coordinator, and then she will cover the part about the current rulemaking that we're engaged in. She knows far more about it than I do. So in our budget for this year, other than the normal operation expenses you would typically expect, we did originally request six additional positions. Four were ultimately included in the governor's budget, governor's recs. We're comfortable with this number if necessary, but we do believe that our workload is going to increase quite a bit in the coming biennium for a number of reasons. So if we stay at the four that is currently in the governor's budget, three would be standards coordinators positions. Those are the ones who do the compliance reviews, check policies, background investigations, handle incoming complaints, and so on. And then we would have one mid-level supervisory position to help with supervision, because right now there's only myself and the assistant director and then 15 staff members. So by adding the four, we need to help out a little bit from the supervision standpoint. Workload has increased for POST in recent years due to legislation, which I know is well known to most of you here. There was a creation of the Citizens Advisory Council, 15 members, separate and distinct from the POST Board, that provides input to the POST Board on policy items. We have had increased complaint reporting due to the real-time requirement under the reform legislation from a couple years ago. And then additional continuing education mandates that require tracking. We are doing, along those lines, we are doing much more in-depth vetting of CE courses, both as a result of discussions we've had over the last couple years, also based on the audit that was done of POST shortly after I took over. We require all mandated training courses, meeting the mandated training areas, be assessed by POST staff. This wasn't always the case in the past. Accredited sponsors were able to review their own courses. We now review every single one of those that comes through. We made our agency compliance reviews much more comprehensive. We had reviewed additional files when we do agency visits, particularly related to background investigations. We ensure the appropriate checks have been made and so on. We are working on developing and incorporating more resources for new and existing chief law enforcement officers to help them with compliance, both on the CE side and also in terms of vetting and hiring candidates. POST has been taking a much more active role in approaching the legislature for bills to help us accomplish our mission. As this committee, in fact, heard a couple of mine recently. This is something that, since I took over in 2020, has been requested by members of both sides of the aisle, basically asking for POST to come forth with ideas rather than it having to go the other way around. So we've been doing our best to try and be proactive in that sense. We also anticipate an increased workload because of rule changes enacted by the board, which Rebecca will cover in more in depth. And then these were recently approved by the ALJ and the governor's office, so we have every confidence they will go into effect in the next couple of months. And we anticipate more work because of those rule changes. Also, in the interest of not only being a regulator, but also trying to assist the profession with many of the challenges they face, which I know this committee is well aware of and has heard a lot about, we are trying to do what we can within our sphere of control to assist in those areas. As an example, we are currently working on exploring partnerships with interested citizens, law enforcement, and pre-service education providers to find ways to help get more people interested in joining the profession and streamlining some of those processes. In terms of the final piece of the budget, which is the additional space request, that is goes part and parcel with the additional staff. We need to accommodate that additional staff, but I will note, as we have all learned across all industries with the new work from home and working remotely environment that we operate in, we're not looking at a straight one-to-one. We're looking at some office sharing and other options to keep things efficient and be cognizant of the fact we don't need as much space as we maybe would have, you know, a couple years ago. So for all of these reasons, I believe the budget is speaks for itself and is reasonable, given additional resources that we will need to carry out our duties efficiently and effectively. With that, concludes my remarks on the budget. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Director. And I think instead of opening up for questions now, we might as well hear the full post-presentation, yep, and then we can go forward with member questions. So Rebecca Gaspard, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your presentation.
Thank you, Chair Moeller and representatives. I'm Rebecca Gaspard. I'm a Rules and Legislative Coordinator for Post Board, and I've been asked to brief the committee on the recent rules that we are almost nearly through the process with, specifically paying most attention to the recent ALJ report on the rules and where we are with it. So just a little bit of background. The board has been aware for some years that the rules needed to be updated. Many of the rules are decades old and don't reflect the current issues facing the board or the profession. So in August of 2020, the board started the formal rulemaking process, notifying everyone that we were beginning that process and also soliciting persons who are interested in serving on an advisory committee for the board to help us promulgate new rules. And the board appointed a 20-member committee made up of law enforcement representatives, organizations, community activists, community associations, academic individuals, members of the public, and so on. And that group has worked fairly tirelessly for the last couple of years and has got us through this first point of the first phase of the rules update. So this update focuses on the selection of officers, the selection process. So we looked at background investigations, psychological screening, the actual minimum selection standards, and the standards of conduct that apply to officers once they become licensed. There were hearings. Well, I should back up a little bit. We had more than 1,600 comments. A lot of support, a lot of concern about different areas. We had two hearings in December. The rules went to the ALJ with some modifications that the board made. At every step of the way, the board has made modifications in response to comments and concerns and suggestions, public input essentially. And the final modifications went to the ALJs in December. And we received their report on January 12th. Then the report approved all of the rules with the exception of three areas where they found defects. And those three areas are summarized for you in the sheet that's titled Review of the Proposed Rules. So you have the actual ALJ's report, you have the draft rules as they are now, and you have that little summary kind of thing. So I'll just briefly touch on those three points. So the first area had to do with Brady Giglio, and if you're not familiar with that, that's a term referencing some court cases that essentially established a requirement for prosecutors to relay information that might be favorable to the defense or the accused in a proceeding. So it's important to know that sometimes that information that gets relayed does not necessarily mean that an officer has done anything wrong. It might just be that there's some association, maybe they had prior contact with a person in the case. It could also mean there was some kind of troublesome concern about the behavior or maybe even some procedural missteps. So it's not necessarily a negative, but that's one of the areas that the board wanted to be aware of, both in the minimum selection process when an officer is currently licensed and applies at a different agency, then they go back through the minimum selection requirements, or for anyone who might be transferring to Minnesota and has been a officer in a different state. So we have information about Brady Giglio and a couple parts of the rule card. And that is an area that generated a lot of concern. And as a result of the concern and the suggestions, particularly from the Minnesota County Attorneys Association, the board made a number of modifications. But the judges looked at the modifications and found one that they felt the language wasn't clear, made some suggestions. The board reviewed the information from the judges and adopted those suggestions and made those modifications. The second area had to do with the issue of hate groups. I'm sure you're all aware that the board promulgated rules saying that it would be a violation of standards of conduct and an issue in the minimum selection process were a person to be associated with a white supremacist, a hate group, an extremist group, or a criminal gang. So that was also an area that got a lot of support, but also a lot of concern from law enforcement who were interested in how exactly would that be applied. And the judges spent a lot of time on that in their report. That's probably most of their concern or areas was looking at that because it's a very complicated issue, as you know. So they found a couple of things that they suggested that we could do to cure what they saw as defects there. One of those was the rules as proposed established a criteria to determine what would be a hate group or an extremist group. And the judges pulled that out of there and set it in a separate section for definitions to make it a little bit more clear that it was a definition and did some modifications of the language. For the hate group part, they removed the reference to white supremacists and they left it at hate groups and extremist groups. They tightened up the language a little bit. And they made some modifications or suggested modifications that the board could adopt to cure the defects that the judges found in those areas. The board reviewed those modifications and adopted those at the last board meeting. The last area that there was a defect had to do with minimum age for licensure. So currently there is no minimum age requirement to become licensed as an officer in the state of Minnesota. And the board considered a lot of ages and came up with the age of 18. Motivated by the concern that with the increasing number of young individuals who are able to practically finish a post-secondary degree while they're still in high school, and looking forward and seeing that we could have persons who, in the board's opinion, might be too young to be a law enforcement officer. The board selected 18. There was some concern about that, and NAMI, National Association of Mental Illness in Minnesota, had a very robust concern about that, citing the amount of evidence that's out there that says that your brain really doesn't fully develop to your age 25, and suggesting as a fallback perhaps age 21. And the board considered that but felt we couldn't really justify the difference between the maturity level, either emotional maturity or social maturity level of a person at age 18 versus 21. We couldn't find that marker of difference, and so the board left it at age 18. The judges looked at everything and decided, yeah, you still haven't distinguished why 18 would be better than 21. And so they felt that we hadn't met that burden of showing that. And so that was a defect. And the board's response to that was to conclude that we still can't find that evidence to distinguish between an 18-year-old or a 19-year-old. And so we withdrew that rule. So the rules went back with modifications, as you can see in your copy, highlighted in red if it's a little bit easier to notice them. Went back to the chief administrative law judge who approved those changes. From there, it went to the governor's office. The governor's office has approved it. We're going forward. Right now, we're waiting on the official reviser draft of those rules. And our understanding is that we can expect that, given that they're in the middle of the legislative season, in mid-March to mid-April. So once we get that, it goes back to the Office of Administrative Hearings. From there, the office, with our signed order adopting those rules, And then that goes to the Secretary of State, who notifies the governors. That starts a 14-day veto period for the governor. Following that, we can publish those rules, and they'll be implemented. So we're anticipating they'll be implemented sometime in May. Possibly could be delayed if there's some delay with the legislature activities with the revisor's office. And if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Great. Thank you so much. Thanks to both of you for your presentations. We can open it up now to member questions. Representative Frazier.
I want to thank you both for being here for the presentation today, and I also want to thank you for just you can share with the post board members for the work they've done on the rules process and the engagement that they did. I thought it was very thorough. I looked at a lot of the comments that came in, so I know the work was there to get the feedback that they needed to get to this point. So thank you for doing that. But Director Mitchell, so I had a question in the ALJ report in regards to after the ALJ says, you know, approves the rules, they also came up with a recommendation of how many staff would be needed to deal with the influx of the new work. Can you talk a bit about, because I think in the governor's budget proposal, it doesn't reach that number that was recommended by the ALJ. And I'm asking this question because I'm coming up a little bit later, which I do reach that number, or at least I provide appropriations to reach that number. Can you talk a bit about the potential impact of not reaching that recommended number that the ALJ has provided based on their thoughts?
Director Mitchell.
Thank you, and thank you for the question. yes, and again, I think I've made this or said this before. You know, having my old municipal budgeting hat on, I try to be as conservative as possible with the taxpayers' money. The estimate is, I think, appropriate, and it is based on what we think is going to be coming as a result of these rules in terms of activity. So I was kind of, to some extent, when I requested six, kind of splitting the baby, so to speak, trying to get to what I thought was a reasonable number. I do think the work will be there without a doubt. Again, we're somewhat looking in a crystal ball, like how much impact is this going to have, but I think the and I believe it was eight was suggested in the report. There's certainly work for them to do, and my intent would not only be to, of course, address the added workload that we already have and then whatever comes as a result of the rules, but also shore up some of our regulatory activities in terms of compliance reviews and whatnot. For example, many agencies will only see us once every 4 to 5 years. I'd like to move that up, provide more resources for CLIOs and agencies to be able to comply and get ahead of the curve and that kind of thing. So I hope that answers your question.
Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. It does, and I'm glad you added that other context because those are some of the things I was thinking about. We've had conversations in the past about the regulatory pieces and the review process and the cycle and how long it takes to get back to particular local departments. And I want to make sure you have the resources you need to make that more frequent to be more thorough. So thank you.
Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the Director. I just want to talk about CEUs real quick. It sounds like you've had a process here, and I don't think there's anybody at this table that hasn't dealt with CEUs in their career. It's a frustrating thing. And so with saying that, if an officer wanted to take a class that he saw or she saw in a brochure in Florida, let's say, the process for that would be to send it into you for approval before they took the class, or would it be a post approval situation? I know that has come up, and I'm just kind of curious how that is dealt with, and then I'll give you one other so you can answer them together. And then with your new procedure, are you seeing quick turnaround with people? Like if someone holds a conference in the state, are you able to get that approval out the door so they can go ahead and post it? Those are the two questions on CEUs, and then a follow-up on that, Madam Chair. And then.
Director Mitchell.
Okay. So to your first question, if they want Minnesota Post credit, the course has to be approved before it's held for that credit. There is a provision for after the fact if they take a course and they want to get credit for it. That won't work for any of the mandatory training areas. But typically, what we have is vendors, if they want to present a course specifically here in Minnesota, they will approach us and they will say, we'd like our, you know, attendees, and it obviously is good for them, for their business model, to have getting post credit. And then they'll submit the course to us, and then we'll tell them what it's approved for, whether it's general ed or if they're trying to get into a mandated area like, say, crisis intervention. That's typically the method. If they would take a course, you know, there are many courses out there offered through, like you said, Florida or some other state. Again, they would have to, the officer themselves, if they wanted credit, would have to submit that to us after the fact with the course curriculum and all the related information to get credit for it.
Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you. Clarifies it. And real quick, this will be, you don't even come back to me, Madam Chair. Page 8 in the document, I'm just curious about the chart that's being used there. It's in the table and contents in this one here. And there's a table in there that it says number of reports and number of allegations. Number of allegations follows the number of reports. So I take it allegations are basically complaints, and then reports are what actually is generated from the pile of allegations, either investigated or not investigated. Would that be a fair statement?
And Director, before you answer, just so people are aware, you're pointing to the table of contents that's a 12-page document. Go ahead.
Thank you, ma'am.
Yep. Go ahead, Director.
Okay. So what it is you can have a singular report, but there might be multiple allegations within it. So the number may be smaller, but it may be that you look at the top 29 reports, 37 allegations. Several of those reports may have had multiple allegations. So that's how that math works out.
Thank you, Ben.
Further questions, discussion? Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. And I agree with NAMI on this. I believe that 18 is too young. From a practical standpoint, by the time you get your college in and get through the academy, you're going to be 20 at a minimum anyway. But I still believe that that's too young. There are CSO programs that have been very successful and would be a pathway, as the letter says, that to policing and keeping people in a profession. But I don't see why we as a state can't set a number at a minimum anymore. You know, if it's just from a practical standpoint, you're going to be potentially handling a lot of alcohol, things that you know, you're not even legally able to purchase it, but you can take it for evidence. It's just a practical standpoint. I think it should be 21.
Thank you. Any further discussion? All right. Thank you both for being here. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Yep. Thanks. And we'll move on to bills, and we've got multiple Representative Frazier bills, so I will let him work his way up to the testifier table. We're going to begin, members, with House File 25, and this is a bill that we heard already. We do have an amendment to this bill. We're not going to be taking any testimony on this bill today or calling on the public because we've heard this bill before. And we are going to be laying it over. So I will move to lay over House File 25. And then, Representative Frazier, would you like to move your amendment to the A8?
Yes, I would, Madam Chair.
All right. Please go ahead and explain the A8 to us.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This amendment simply does one thing. I want to iterate that, or make clear that the majority of the bill stays the same. This deals with a portion of the bill that was, when we initially had it planned, it was for purchasing equipment for law enforcement to deal with bringing down or increasing the clearance rates. So many of you may remember, when we had testimony today, we didn't have anyone testify in regards to that equipment portion of the bill. Then after the presentation of that bill, I had the opportunity to have multiple conversations with law enforcement as well as mental health providers as well. And the focus was really on about how do we provide more resources to shore up our crisis support teams that we have, our mobile crisis response teams that we have in the 87 counties. They are not all created equal. So we want to try to find ways to shore those up, particularly for areas that are more rural to ensure that we can have a response that is there adequate and effective and responsive in a timely manner. The other piece that I recall and with further conversation was that when law enforcement testified, they testified about the resources not really being enough to shore up, maintain, and expand the embedded social worker programs that they have. So what this amendment does is it increases the resources for mental health responses. It creates a portion where it prioritizes collaboration between local governments and law enforcement with the mobile crisis response units that currently exist or mental health professionals. And that is what the amendment does.
Thank you, Representative Frazier. And because we've heard the bill before, we'll only be discussing this amendment. So if you have any questions about the amendment, please let us know. All right, seeing none, all those in favor of the A8 signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails and the A8 amendment is adopted. All right, and like I said, we're gonna skip discussion of the bill. And I renew my motion and lay over House File 25 as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, Representative Frazier, your next bill is House File 855, and I believe your motion is to re-refer House File 855 to the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee.
That is correct, Madam Chair.
All right, and I do see that you have a DE2 amendment. Would you like to move that amendment?
Yes, I would, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And it's my understanding that nonpartisan staff will walk through what that DE2 amendment does.
That is also correct.
All right. We'll call on Mr. Diebel then.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This House file contains much language that was included in a bill last year that was heard by this committee. The DE2 reduces the introduced version by eliminating several sections. I'll touch on what remains in the proposal. Article 1, Section 1 establishes a Public Safety Innovation Board within the Office of Justice Program. On page 2 of the amendment, it lists the powers and duties. The general direction is for the board to increase the efficiency, effectiveness, and capacity of public safety providers, and it enumerates several ways in which the board would do that, including monitoring trends in crime, providing information on criminal trends and research to the commissioner, and awarding grants and evaluating grants. Section 2 of Article 1 appropriates ongoing appropriation of $4.825 million to the Office of Justice Program to increase staffing and in general terms, it's to simplify grant procedures, expand the pool of grant applicants, but specifically it directs the office to hire 8 additional staff members to provide training and technical assistance to grantees, hire 12 additional community outreach specialists, and hire additional grant compliance and financial compliance staff. Section 3 of Article 1 is the appropriation to fund the Innovation Board discussed in Section 1. Moving to Article 2 of the bill, this contains Section 1 modifies the Data Practices Act, the section that covers body camera data. There are 2 key provisions in this. On lines 4.1 and 4.11 of the amendment, this directs agencies to provide complete disclosure of information recordings that are related to discharge of a firearm by a peace officer or where a peace officer uses force and there's substantial bodily harm. The remaining new language in Section 1 of Article 2 relates to disclosure of body camera data and dash cam data to next of kin when a person is killed by the use of force by a police officer, and it establishes timelines for the disclosure to the public as well. Section 2 of Article 2 creates 2 appropriations. One is to the Commissioner of Public Safety to create a statewide cloud-based data storage database. for law enforcement agencies to submit their body camera data. It also appropriates $9 million for agencies to purchase the body cameras for their officers, and it provides detail about who should be considered at the top of the list for eligibility for those grants. Moving to Article 3, this contains a variety of provisions regarding law enforcement policy and oversight. Section 1 permits rather than requires the Post Board to direct a law enforcement agency to conduct an investigation of an allegation of misconduct on behalf of an officer employed by the agency. Section 2 of Article 3 directs the Post Board to adopt a rule that empower the Post Board with taking action on a peace officer misconduct, the violation of the code of conduct, even if the allegation did not result in criminal charges. Section 3 of Article 3 adds additional requirements that must be included in body camera policies adopted by agencies that outfit their officers with body cameras, and these mirror what we discussed earlier in the Data Practices Act. So it directs the agencies in their mandated policies to include the updates to the statutory requirements about disclosure. Article 3, Section 4 would authorize local units of government to establish civilian oversight councils and grant an oversight council the authority to make findings of fact and impose discipline on officers. Article 3, Section 5, this amends an appropriation from 2021, which is an additional $6 million for post-reimbursement of law enforcement training, and it expands the use for these reimbursement grants to include officer training and the use of force. And finally, in Article 3, Section 6, it appropriates an additional appropriates $1.45 million in the first year and $1.203 million in the second year to the Post Board to hire investigators and additional staff to perform compliance reviews and investigate alleged code of conduct violations. That concludes the overview of the DE 2 now.
Thank you, Mr. Diebel. And because this is a DE, my intent is that we'll go ahead and vote on this, and then we'll have full discussion on the bill as amended with this DE. So, all those in favor of the DE2 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion prevails, and the DE2 amendment is adopted. And so now, Representative Frazier, if you want to tell us about your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, staff, for laying that out and for all the work that Mr. Debu, Mr. Johnson, that you both have put in to help me get this in the shape that I need to get into to present it to the committee. So last year I carried the innovation package, and the whole idea was to take an innovative approach, a more data-driven approach to how we address public safety and community safety in the state of Minnesota. We got very close to getting this done last year, so I'm hoping we can get this in place this year. And really it's about innovation. It's about providing local control back to our local jurisdictions in regards to the civilian review boards and what they can do there. It's about transparency when you look at the body camera policies that we want to put in place to allow families to have access. And we know and we've seen how this can kind of bring the temperature down around things when they happen in our community when we have that type of transparency. It also provides an opportunity to help build trust between law enforcement and the community, because we can see what's happening and we can have those conversations. I do have I don't know if I need anyone to testify. But I do have staff here from the from DPS if there are specific questions about things. But this bill is really focused on providing resources for law enforcement and also building those collaborative connections and helping to build trust between the community. That's what the focus of the bill is. So I will stand for any particular questions.
Thank you, Representative Frazier. Do we have anybody from the public who wishes to testify? All right, I'm not seeing any, so we can open it up for member discussion. It's a very low-key committee today.
Just you, I heard that. Just
you. Yeah, Vice Chair Feist, go ahead. Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to thank you for bringing this bill to us. I think it's really important and will do a lot of good. And specifically, I just wanted to reference the civilian review section, allowing civilian review councils to really have a role in public safety. I think this is a really positive development. We'll build trust and also allow local communities to really figure out what they need to have those relationships and to support public safety. So thank you.
Further member discussion?
I struggle to even want to speak on the bill.
Go ahead, Representative Rabbani.
I struggle to even speak on the bill. And I realize that this is the accumulation of several years worth of work and the path we've been going on. I think there's a whole bunch of gotchas in this bill. I'm not in favor of, I'm not going to vote for it. I realize where it's going to go, but we've got public innovation board. We're putting people on this council that most of which are appointed by the governor and really aren't involved in law enforcement. I can't imagine if this is a medical board or if this was a aviation board, the council wouldn't look like this if we wanted to improve aviation safety. The civilian review boards, we've talked about this multiple times. There's nothing prohibiting civilian review boards from being established in local agencies right now. I think the body camera provisions, many of which are fine, but there's a couple nuggets in there that are going to trip people up. And we don't need to beat the horse here, but I'm a no. But thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Viney, I would like to, the pieces, I'm not sure exactly of the pieces that you believe are the gotchas or will catch people up, but I would like to talk, if we can offline, talk about those, because I do, the bill's not, we're not done yet. So if we can talk about those, I'd like to get your thoughts and I can see if I can clear up any misunderstandings about the trip you up points, because a bill that's most basically designed to create more transparency and build trust, I don't want to have gotcha pieces in there. And I'm sure we're going to hear from law enforcement as they read thoroughly through the bill and get their feedback as well. So we'll be trying to incorporate that. And just in regards to the innovation board, there will be more conversation around that in terms of who's representative of that board. There was some compromise language that we got to toward the end of last year that is not in here, so I'm going to go back and take a look at that. But I'd love to get your thoughts so we can see if there's any way we can work together to make sure that board is representative in a way you think it needs to be.
Representative Frazier, you just said the innovation board. Did you mean the civilian?
No, I meant the I believe that Representative Votney was speaking to the innovation board with OJP.
My apologies.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Excuse me then.
Yeah.
All right, any further discussion? Any additional closing comments?
No, I think it's a good bill as is, but I'm always willing to work with Representative Votney has a background in law enforcement. I'm always willing to get that perspective to make sure we can make the bill better. So I would appreciate any support that we can get.
Thank you, Representative Frazier. And with that, you renew your motion that House File 855, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. All right. I think your final bill with us today, Representative Frazier, is House File 538. Give me a second, my papers got mixed up here. All right, so I believe that your motion is for House File 538 to be recommended to be placed on the General Register.
That is correct, Madam Chair.
And I see that you have a DE2 amendment. So would you like to move that amendment?
Yes, Madam Chair.
All right. And please go ahead and explain the DE2 amendment.
The DE2 amendment is essentially modifies this language and aligns it with what the post board rules that were put in place and approved by the ALJ.
Great, thank you. And I do see that we have an A1 amendment to the DE2 amendment. Who's going to be offering the A1? Representative Hudson to the A1.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, as I was looking over this morning, I wish I could go back and submit a different amendment because, frankly, I don't understand the purpose of any of the language in lines 2.5 through 2.8. Hate or extremist group means a group that, as demonstrated by its official statements or principles, the statements of its leaders or members or its activities, one, promotes the use of threats, force, violence, or criminal activity. Okay. Great. Don't want cops who are promoting the use of threats, force, violence, and criminal activity. I don't understand why there isn't just a period there, and we don't just go straight to number two, which is promoting seditious activities. The breakdown of, like, the different ways in which promotions of threats, force, violence, or criminal activity, by delineating it, it almost implies that there might be some circumstances where it would be okay to promote the use of threats, force, violence, or criminal activity. So if you could speak to that, I would appreciate it. But what this amendment does is it specifically deletes the words political, religious, or ideological from the list of goals that could be achieved through these groups. Because as I read it, I don't understand how, from a First Amendment perspective, we can specifically target political, religious, or ideological activity. And if we're going to, if the concern here is use of threats, force, violence, or criminal activity, then let's focus on that rather than focusing on the ideas in people's heads. So I would, despite the fact that I wish my amendment was a little bit different, I still would encourage members to vote for it. Thank you.
Representative Frazier to the A1 amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Hudson, I'd love to hear offline about the other amendment that you wish you would have brought later on. We can talk about that. But, this is not intended to attack individuals in a religious or a political manner. When you read this definition as a whole, it is about groups that demonstrate it by mental statements or principles that will be violent, that will be hateful. That is the intent of this, to address those particular groups. And if those groups have that particular hateful, violent, extremist mission, and then you have an individual that is trying to further that through political, religious, or discriminatory ideological instances, this will address those issues. That is the intent of the of this bill.
Great. Discussion to the A1 amendment. Representative Beckerfin.
Thank you, Chair Mohler. And I just wanted to state, you know, my understanding of the First Amendment, I mean, you really have to, again, you have to read the whole thing together. Promotes the use of threats, force, violence, or criminal activity to achieve goals. So no, like, political, ideological, religious speech is protected, but not when you're using it to further violence and criminal activity. So I think it would withstand the First Amendment scrutiny. Thank you.
Further discussion to the A1. Vice Chair Feist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I see Representative Hudson's point, and I think it might just be a drafting issue. I think the goal we all agree on, but there might be an and in there that we could add in somewhere, or we could add something to the subdivision two before we get into the enumerated examples. So just a thought.
Further discussion to the A1. Representative Novotny.
Chair Mohler, would you and the author consider a verbal amendment to line 2.7 and the or to and?
I think that really changes the overall intent.
Could
Representative Frazier.
Would I like to, if we can get comments from nonpartisan.
Well, and hang on one second. Let's go back for a second because we're still on the A1, and I think that change that you requested is to the DE. So let's hold that thought, now nonpartisan is aware of that issue coming up in a minute. So let's hold that and continue on discussion. Did you have anything specific to the A1, Representative Devotny?
We'll follow up in a second then,
Sounds good. Great. Closing comments on the A1, Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm going to take the optimistic path on this and withdraw the amendment. And my reason for doing so is I think I understand, or let's put it this way, I would like to understand what the intent is, and we can have follow-up conversations about that. To the point regarding reading the entirety of the language that Representative Becker-Finn raises, that's exactly why I have this concern, is because, as I stated, when I read that we're trying to exclude people from being police officers who promote the use of threats, force, violence, and criminal activity, to me, that's the end of the sentence. I don't understand why we would need to go through examples of what their motivations would be in doing so. If they're promoting threats, force, violence, or criminal activity, then that should be achieving the goal. So we can speak further offline about whether you agree with that or if there's other ways to approach this further along in the process. Thank you.
All right. With that, we'll move to a vote on the A1 amendment. All those.
I went through it.
You went through it. Yeah. Sorry. I need more caffeine today, clearly. All right. So now we'll move on to the DE2 amendment. And then, Representative Novotny, would you like to speak to the DE2 amendment?
Well, as I said before, Chair Mueller, I think we'd need to look at that. I could see this easily being misinterpreted by an administrator of a department that I know of people that have been disciplined or lost rank for making a simple political statement on Facebook. I could see this easily being misinterpreted without including that suggested language, and I would request that we look at laying this over and get the language agreeable.
All right. I'll just note that this language was taken exactly from the rules that the Post Board talked about. Is that correct?
It was taken. Yeah. The reason for my amendment is to align this exactly, explicitly with the rules that were approved by the ALJ. So it has been vetted by a judge, taking a look and saying that they believe that this is the language that would pass First Amendment constitutional muster.
And because this is a DE amendment, I mean, typically we usually adopt those author's amendment. So my intent is to adopt the amendment, and then we can move to a discussion of the bill as amended. All right. All those in favor of the DE2 amendment signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails, and the DE2 amendment is adopted. All right. Now we can move on to discussion of the bill as amended. Vice Chair Feist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to correct myself because Ben Johnson just explained some structural things to me. So when we're talking about the line 2.8, where these organizations are achieve goals that are political, religious, discriminatory, or ideological, that's not, I was thinking that related back to just the overall subdivision too, but it's only relating to organizations that already promote the use of threats, force, violence, or criminal activity. And I was not understanding that. I was thinking that that stood in isolation, but Representative Becker-Finn understood that, and I agree with her now. So thanks. I just wanted to make that clarification.
Right. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Let me start by saying something that shouldn't have to be said. I don't want cops to be white supremacists. And I think if I ask for head nods of everybody around the room, none of us want cops to be white supremacists. My problem with this bill, in the context that it's being offered, is that in our modern political and cultural discourse, the term white supremacy has a very broad meaning to certain people, and some of those people have institutional power. I have direct and personal, impactful experience with actual textbook white supremacy. In fact, I am literally, biologically, physically, the antithesis of white supremacy. Actual white supremacists regard me and my children as abominations. That's how they talk about me and people like me in their discussions amongst each other. And that white supremacy is something that needs to be rooted out and eradicated from our culture entirely. That end of eradicating actual white supremacy is actually thwarted by diluting its meaning, by broadening it out to include all sorts of things which are not at all white supremacy and have nothing whatsoever to do with the belief that the white race is superior to other races and that those other races, to one degree or another, shouldn't be tolerated. That's a very specific belief that we should engage with directly and condemn thoroughly. It's difficult to do that, though, when we broaden the definition of white supremacy to include a bunch of things that aren't in. And I'll give you an example. So merely 3 years ago, in 2020, there was a display at the Smithsonian National Museum for African American History and Culture. And in this display, they defined whiteness as including a wide variety of things. And these are among the list of things that were considered to be whiteness in the context of considering and discussing white supremacy. Rugged individualism, self-reliance and independence, the nuclear family structure, objective, rational, linear thinking, cause and effect, quantitative emphasis, Protestant work ethic, working hard as the key to success, work before play, Christianity as normal, respecting authority, valuing property, having a future orientation, planning for the future, timeliness. It's a pretty broad list of things that have nothing whatsoever to do with white supremacy as I defined it. And so my concern is that regardless of the current intention, that by specifically targeting, and it kind of goes back to my amendment, I don't want my cops to be members of hate groups either, but I want to know what we mean by hate group. I don't want my cops to promote the use of threats, force, violence, or criminal activity. Yes, 100%. But why can't we just say that? Why does it have to be specifically articulated as we're going after the white supremacists? And if we're going to do that, if we're just going to carve them out as if nobody else is capable of promoting the use of threats, force, violence, or criminal activity, then we better know who it is that we're talking about, because I know from just observing society in recent years that there will be people who try to argue that groups that are not white supremacists are white supremacists under their deviation from the actual definition. So that's why I can't vote for this bill. Thank you.
Representative Frazier, and then I also made a mistake of not asking if anybody wanted to testify yet. I clearly have not had enough coffee today. So if you can go ahead and respond, and then we'll do that.
Yeah, I'll make it quick. Thank you for sharing and that personal story as well. And as a black man, but spent a lot of time in the Deep South as a kid, I can relate to how white supremacists view us don't want us to be in certain spaces just like this that we're in now. So I always think it's very important that when we're here, we talk about that and we point that out. And also we do things to break up those structures and break up those cycles. But you'll be happy to know, Representative Hudson, that white supremacists is not in this bill. It doesn't focus on white supremacists. It focuses on hate or extremist groups. So I hope that addresses your issue.
All right. Thank you, Representative Frazier. And we'll back up for a minute, too. I didn't know if you had any testifiers who wanted to speak to this bill.
No.
Okay. And then are there any members of the public who wish to testify on this bill? I see Mr. Evanstadt's raised his hand. Please come forward.
Good
can introduce yourself again for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Mueller, members of the committee. Is it okay if I make some remarks? I was late coming because of plasma and the thug train, and I had signed up to testify on the previous bill with Rep. Frazier that was talked about between Brady violations and funding the post board.
Oh, no, we actually didn't take any testimony on that because that was a post board presentation.
So okay, the bill, though, from, so I was listening to it, the bill from where you made the call for the testifiers in the audience, I just missed it, the last bill.
Okay.
Would that be okay?
We're done with that bill right now.
Okay.
And so right now we're on House File 538.
Okay. Then I'm, and this is for funding for law enforcement in some capacity, correct?
It's not, actually.
Okay. All right, then maybe I can just cut to the chase then. I've heard today in the testimony about Brady violations, Giglio violations.
Mr. Epstein, that was just a post presentation, and we didn't take any public testimony on that. We're on House File 538 right now, as amended. It is a bill regarding hate or extremist groups in law enforcement. That is the only thing it does.
Okay, thank you.
This is your last chance to testify specifically to this bill, or if not, we're going to move on.
Okay, thank you very much, Chair Mueller, members of the committee. On I think it was March 14th of 2014, I was sitting in my vehicle in Edina, facing out and waiting for my dad to come down. And then Hennepin County Sheriff's Office, two officers, Lisa Kasparek and Jeffrey Marshall, came out and they pointed their guns at me in a felony arrest for having committed the crimes, apparently, of trying to engage my sheriff at his home because he wouldn't engage me in public at his work for 2 years, and then going to ask my prosecutor who put me in prison.
I'm hearing a personal story that doesn't relate to
okay, me. Then as far as the bill is, then I had these people calling me the N-word, okay? They screamed the N-word at me, Chair Mueller. You know, and with respect, I know that you are apparently either currently a prosecutor or an ex-prosecutor. I'd like to have my say. They screamed the N-word at me, and they called me an N-lover. Okay, Cedric Frazier? And I've reached out to you for months. So all I have to say, and I'll wrap this up, the police in that instance on March 14th of 2014 called me an N-lover. They said, who is that N on your shirt? And I said, this is Bob Marley, prophet of God. Now what? And he said, here's what. And Jeffrey Marshall cocked back, and he hit me not once, force 10 with a closed fist, not twice, three times. And then anyway, it goes all the way to Chief John Tunheim at the U.S. District Court, and they have two lawyers on the case,
all right,
and I have none.
This is beyond the
thank you very much.
All right. Back to member discussion. Representative Beckerfin.
Thank you. Love to actually talk about this bill. You know, I think this is a good bill. I think for the public's, you know, sort of information, you know, as introduced, that did have language around white supremacy. And I do think it is important to note, you know, that the DE2 broadens that out and, you know, to the point that Representative Hudson made, you know, doesn't use that language because we don't want hate and extremist groups to be, infiltrating our government and our law enforcement in any way. But I do think, you know, why do we target white supremacy? Why do we call it out? Why do we say it? I think, you know, and I was looking at a dictionary definition. There's actually two definitions, and one of them is the one that Representative Hudson spoke to, the belief that white race is inherently superior and that white people should have control over people of other races. But there is a second one, and I think, you know, I can only speak for myself, but sometimes when we talk about white supremacy, we're also talking about these social, economic, and political systems that collectively enable white people to maintain power over people of other races. And I think those are the definitions that in statutory interpretation that a judge is going to look to, like whatever exhibit, art, whatever, you know, you can find somebody on the internet to say anything. That isn't necessarily going to speak to the way that this bill would be interpreted. But I do think it is instructive to our conversation because we do have instances. There is a reason that it was drafted that way originally. I do think the DE2 makes it a better bill, and I support that. But I just think, you know, the sort of rhetorical question, why do we have to target white supremacy? Well, this is America. Because that's what a lot of America was founded on. And so I think it is important that we do have these conversations out in the open in front of the public and do talk about that, because that is, that's the history that we deal with that dictated why these systems are the way they are now. And so I think this is an important discussion, and I'm glad to see this moving forward. And I know we will continue to work on making the bill better, but I just wanted to bring that up and sort of talk about that a little bit in the context of this overall bill. So thank you, Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Representative Becker-Finn. Representative Ingen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Frazier, for bringing this bill forward. I think I couldn't say it any better than Representative Hudson did earlier, but as I'm reading this bill, on 2.4 of the DE2, we all agree to that. Promotes the use of threats, force, violence, or criminal activity. That in and of itself, 100% in agreement with that. Where I have issue is 2.10 and 2.9, where it says, or advocates for differences in the right to vote, speak, assemble, travel, maintain citizenship, yada, yada. That's simply an advocacy of, not promoting the use of threats, force, violence, or criminal activity. It wasn't that long ago that we took up a bill that expanded the right to vote to folks who were incarcerated, convicted of a felony, and they were applicable to vote prior to their full sentence being served. If a police officer had engaged in discussions or belonging to a group that said this was wrong, would they be exempt from being a police officer?
Representative Frazier.
If it's done with the promotion of use of threats, force, violence, or criminal activity, yes.
Representative Ingen.
From what I'm reading, that wouldn't be the case, because it's or advocates for differences. As it reads, I could simply advocate for a difference, and I would not be eligible to become a police officer. Could I have nonpartisan clarify that for me?
Mr. Debo.
Madam Chair, Engen members, I think the key provision in Clause 3 is it applies to any protected class, as far as the example that was provided. So if it's felon voting, they're not a protected class. And so it's based on color, race, religion, national origin, disability, sex. But to the point that Representative Frazier said, it doesn't have to be tied to force or violence.
Representative Ingen.
It does not have to be tied to threats of force or violence. That's our issue here. This is subjective language that can be read by somebody in the context of their own bias. And that in and of itself is diminishing to the actual definition that we're looking at getting at here. And saying that somebody who is belonging to a hate or an extremist group, we should clearly define that. Because if it can change on a whim, if it can be something that is subjectively interpreted, we are diluting what it means to be a member of these horrible, horrible groups. So I would urge that we change this language. I can't support it as it stands. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Frazier.
Madam Chair and Representative Ingalls, let me be clear. After what nonpartisan staff just said, that it has to be based on race, sexual orientation, gender identity, public assistance status, or any protected class as defined in Minnesota state statutes of federal law, you're saying you're okay with that?
Representative Ingen.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. I'm saying that it is wrong to have subjective terminology as to what constitutes belonging to a hate or an extremist group that can change, such as in gender identity. This was something that was fiercely contentious not even 5-10 years ago. Now, we understand that everybody has rights. Everybody should be treated with respect and dignity. But as time progressed, so did our lines of thinking. And that means that we can go back retroactively and claim that somebody was a member of a hate or a supremacist group because they were of a different line of thought. So that's where my concern is that this is a means to an end to claim that somebody is one of the most egregious things that society can offer. Hate. Does that make sense, Representative Frazier?
Representative Frazier.
No, that doesn't clear it up for me. I guess the question I had was, are you okay with folks discriminating based on these protected class statuses?
And I think rather than going, we do have another member with a comment, so I'm going to move on right now and we'll see where that takes us. All right, Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Chair Mueller, and thank you, Representative Frazier, for this and for the conversation that we're having. I think that, you know, when I look at this language, we have to look at it in its totality, not just within the context of where we are in history right now. I think that you could pretty well argue anybody who is advocating that a trans person doesn't have the right to vote, you would say that's problematic, right? And I think that that's, when we look at it, it's not just that things have changed, but like that we are advocating whether or not they have these basic rights that we have under the Constitution or not have them based on their membership in a protected class. And I think that, I think you have a good point that what is a protected class has changed, but what we're looking at currently is what is a protected class now, which is enumerated here and which potentially could change in the future because of that, but also that we know that that's a good thing because, you know, if I was alive when the Constitution was written, I would not be able to vote, right? I wouldn't be seen as a whole person. And so you're right, like things might change in the future, but things that were done to groups of people in the past, we now look at them and we say, yeah, that's hate. That's hate based on what our understanding is of the human condition at this time. And I think we can't predict what's gonna happen in the future, but what we're doing here, it's pretty clear. I mean, these are protected classes that extend to things like employment law, that extend to a whole host of different areas of law. And I don't think that it's unclear to say that if you are a person who is advocating for somebody to not be able to speak, to vote, to travel, to assemble, to maintain their citizenship based on one of these protected classes, that is hate. I don't think that's unclear at all. I think that's pretty spelled out pretty clearly. Thank you.
Thank you. Further member discussion? Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. And Representative Frazier, a year ago when you brought this forward and we had the hearing and I said, you change the language, make it neutral, and I would vote for it. So I am going to vote for this. That being said, I think Representative Hollins' statement that you just said points out the problem that we have in the interpretation of this, because it sounds to me like what Representative Hollins just said would indicate that three alone would be enough to qualify for a violation of this. So I think we can get down to something with a little work that would clear it up, and I just think it needs to be, if all the years of law experience that we have on that side of the table and we can't go specifically and we have to look to someone else for an interpretation of a law, I think that to me is an indication that we need to make it more clear. So as I said, I'll vote for it. I hope, Representative Frazier, that we can clean this up and make it specific so there's no vagueness in what the bill means.
Closing remarks, Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Novotny, and to all the members for your comments. I'll just quickly to the point, I go to nonpartisan because they're nonpartisan, and I would hope that they would have the credibility to speak to what the bill says, because as a partisan person, you're not just going to take my word for it when I say it doesn't mean it's going to do what you think it's going to do. So I think staff is important. So staff, thank you for your input. This bill is about rooting out hate in one of our core industries that serves our communities. We're in a place now where we're lacking extreme trust in our law enforcement. This is a bill designed to help build that bridge and build that pathway to where we can have more trust, we can have more transparency. It is designed so our communities hear and know that we're saying, we know that there's a problem. We got to this bill when I carried my first year because the FBI designated white supremacist groups as one of the most extreme threats to our democracy. That's how we ended up here. What we're telling our community by putting something in place like this, what we're telling our state and what we're telling the rest of the country after what happened in our state, is that we take this serious. We're listening to the data. We're listening to what our national intelligence folks are saying to us. We're listening to what law enforcement has uncovered when we had civil unrest and protests and who came to our states and our cities to cause harm and damage. We're listening to those things. And because we're listening, we're putting legislation in place to ensure that we root that out of our public servants. They take an oath to protect and serve, and that means everybody. And we're putting something in place to ensure that because it means everybody, they don't have any preconceived notions of any particular groups that they will not protect and serve. It means everybody, and we want to make sure that it means everybody. And if it doesn't mean everybody for those individuals, if they have any type of hate and they want to promote violence toward those individuals, we do not want them serving in our communities. And we want to make that very clear. That's what this bill will do. I urge your support.
Thank you. And with that, Representative Frazier renews the motion that House File 538, as amended, be recommended to be placed on the general register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. All right. Thank you, Representative Frazier, for presenting all your bills to us today. And last but certainly not least, we have Representative Novotny's bill, House File 2253. And as you work your way up to the testifier table, Representative Novotny, I believe that your motion is that House File 2253 be re-referred to the Committee on Higher Education, Finance, and Policy. Is that your motion, Representative?
That is my motion.
All right, great. And I see that you also have the A2 amendment. Would you like to first move your A2 amendment?
I would.
And please explain that amendment.
The A2 amendment, this bill was originally heard last year, and after taking input from members of this committee, there were several improvements that then Chair Mariani made that we incorporated into the bill that went on to the omnibus bill. When we originally redrafted the bill this year, it had the original language. We had this is incorporating the language as it left public safety last year.
Thank you, Representative Novotny. All those in favor of the A2 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the A2 amendment is adopted. And if you want to go ahead and tell us about your bill as amended, please.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. Thank you, Chair Moeller. He left
I've
an
been,
impression
I've been
on
called
me.
Lots of other things, but never Chair Mariani. So go ahead.
Mean it in a good way. This bill is something I've worked on with several members here for almost 2 years. As a standalone bill, this has the goal of achieving providing professional police officer education in an in-service setting on the proper use of force, including deadly force, the duty to intercede, and the duty to de-escalate, along with training and post-traumatic stress and the proper way to deal with that in a constructive, not destructive manner. This bill would provide funding through the Office of Higher Education that would implement in-service multi-agency training that is close to the real situations as we can provide. Currently, POST provides requirements for use of force training. Most of that use of force training is done in-house. By that I mean the State Patrol will do use of force training with the State Patrol, the DNR with the DNR. But at the end of the chase, at 2 o'clock in the morning, three counties from where the chase ended, you're going to be dealing with people you may have never met, and there could be great differences. You could be a officer from a small community with 2 months on the job, and there might be a member of a state agency that just had his brand new squad totaled,
in the chase, and he might not be in control of his or her emotions. And is that new officer on the street going to have the wherewithal to say and recognize that that officer that he's working with and that is on a scene that he had no control over needs to be redirected and the situation needs to be de-escalated? As we went through this, I met with several members in the state on use of force training and overall peace officer training. I've met with psychologists. I've met with law enforcement leaders. And this is where the bill end that we came up with and the idea that I proposed. We have great facilities in the state at places like the Alexandria Vocational Technical and Community College. They keep adding words to the name from when I went to school there. And they have, for example, a use of force facility where they have catwalks over the top and can watch and observe and manipulate lighting and noise. And it's just incredible, realistic. And it's the kind of realistic training that we need to have to put those people in a situation that they're not going to get in a mat room training with people that they usually have. This bill is not to replace the current post-board use of force training. It's meant to be in addition to and give that multi-agency experience at a high level of training using state-level trainers that we already have, state-level facilities, and almost more importantly, the state-level actors that are going to train and give the direction and responses that we hope to instill on them. So the situation where this might be something that they deal with the day after this training, it might be 2 to 5 years after, but whenever they have that situation that they can go back to this and talk about that and have that as a reference. With me, I have Scott Berger, who is currently the I'll let him introduce himself, I believe, Scott is a longtime trainer at Alexandria, and with him is Tom Draper, who is at Hennepin Technical Institute as the peace officer training leader. I'll let them introduce themselves, and they'll talk about the actual way that the program will run.
All right, thank you. I don't know who's up first. I'm assuming it's Scott Berger. Oh. Are you Scott Berger?
Yeah, I guess so.
Okay. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
All right. I'm Scott Berger, and I'm currently the Vice President of Academic and Student Affairs with the Alexandria Technical and Community College. And prior to that, I had been the post-board coordinator of the law enforcement program for 14 years and 20 years of law enforcement before that. So when Paul first reached out to us a few years ago, I'll be honest with you, I was great working with him, but I had no aspirations to sit in this chair. So this is not something I got up in the morning thinking, oh, yes, finally. So just know that's my perspective. I'm proud to be here, though, to provide whatever answers or insight that I can.
All right. Hi, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin. You might need to pull closer to the mic because these mics don't pick up.
I'll move this over. How's that? Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I am Tom Draper. I'm the director and PPOE coordinator at Hennepin Tech. I've worked with Scott Berger often, and we worked with Mr. Novotny on this also to put this together. We both have state-funded facilities. We both have the locations. In the metro, centrally located at Alex, to do this training. I think it's very important, and it, I think, will benefit the profession.
Great. Thank you. Are there members of the public who wish to testify on this bill? All right. I'm not seeing any, so we can move to discussions. And I actually have a question for you. So it's my understanding with the use of force training that these simulation of real world real-life situations is the best type of training out there, and if you could just speak to that, please.
Go ahead, I can go. So it's been a long-time proven thing that scenario-based training assists you in one reason, because it inoculates you to stress. We're in a tabletop exercise. Those stressors aren't the same as if you're in an environment where somebody is contradictory to you or not wanting to follow what the recommendation or directions of the officer are. So if you learn that in a controlled environment, you can stop the scenario in the event that the officer or a student makes a mistake or takes it down the wrong direction. You can pause it and say, okay, this is where you went off the rails. Now let's go back and let's replay it going in the right direction. And that is what our facilities, more than 10 years ago, the legislature committed revenue to Hennepin Tech and Alexandria to upscale our facilities to incorporate what Representative Novotny expressed that we have, with the intent of that was the actual application of the law, of rules of criminal procedure, of use of force, all with the goal of stopping it when you need to and reinitiating it in the event that you have to do that too, but all within reasonableness. So
thank you. Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Novotny, for this bill. I think this is incredibly important, and I'll speak as somebody who's gone through this training. There's a couple things in my mind that are really crucial to this, and one is to understand the difference between kind of the academic setting, right, and then when something actually happens in practice. And your body can't learn how to react to that until you're put in a situation that is closest to reality as possible. And so no matter how many times you read a book, no matter how many times you walk through in a safe environment, until you can get into the mentality where you have some of that added stress level, like in scenario-based in simulation training, you're really not well equipped enough to walk into those situations. And so I know that as a law enforcement student, we all looked forward to the end of skills when we got to use simunition rounds. We all got lovingly tapped in the behind with a round just to practice. But that's how we started, right? Because you're caught off guard a lot of times. And I bring that up because in my particular training scenario, I got hit with a simunition round in the back, just like everybody else. And the point is to turn, and there are two people facing you. One has a gun and one has a badge. And you have this much time before they fire the next round to decide where you should be aiming your firearm. And I took just a fraction of a second, maybe too long. But, you know, I got hit in the thumbnail, cracked my thumbnail. I'd give up my thumb if I made sure that I, you know, had my gun aiming at the right person. So, you know, just kind of a personal story there. And then I'll say, too, that in my class, you know, when we're talking about going through all this training, and it's extensive and excellent training, we had a classmate who towards the end went to the scenario-based training. And just kind of a little, if you have a chance to watch a video of this stuff online, please do. It's incredible. So the instructor sits behind a computer, and they can dictate what happens on the screen based on the student or the person's actions in front of the screen. And we had a student who had gone through the entire program, made it to this final simulation, and when it came time to use deadly force, when the person on the screen obviously became incapacitated, my classmate continued to fire and fire and fire round after round after round into the person's back as they laid on the floor. I bring that up because one time doing this at the end of your education is not enough, and I would like to see this used more, I just wanted to point that out. I think this is incredible, and I thank you for it.
Thank you. Representative Novotny.
Thank you for your comments, Representative Curran. We look at situations like the Uvalde situation in Texas where people stood by.
Minnesota had a program, I don't know if it's still running, called 3ECHO, and that was one of the inspirations for me to get this program going, large use of active shooter in the school training. And one of the things that I saw as someone who had been a longtime use of force instructor is people that hadn't been through multiple situations like this, they would freeze up. And that was just simmunitions. As you pointed out, simmunitions, they hurt, especially if they hit the wrong spot. But that is a reinforcing thing. And it kind of ties into, I see we're looking for time, it kind of ties into the other component that we put in this at the suggestion, the PTSD part. When we're going, if you're spending 6 or 7 hours going through these high-stress scenarios, that is the perfect time to sit people down and talk about, okay, so this is a very high-stress situation. How are we going to deal with that? What is the right thing to do? What's not going to help you? And how do you recognize these effects in the people that you're working with? And how do you help them? The ABLE program that some of the departments here in the metro are using, I believe St. Paul PD is using ABLE. It's active bystander law enforcement. And this is, like I said, this is not for replace that. This incorporates the multi-agency, more realistic thing. Dealing with people you don't know that aren't in your chain of command, and having that experience.
Thank you. Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Novotny. I was racking my brain to try and figure out how to talk about how this disproportionately impacts communities of color, but I couldn't figure it out. I just wanted to harass you a little bit. what I wanted to say was I really appreciate the Section 3 here and the amendment that addresses the PTSD. I think that we've done a pretty bad job of protecting and caring for our law enforcement officers in that area and making sure that they're properly prepared and they know what resources are available for them. So in particular, I wanted to call out that section and just thank you for including it because I think it's really important.
Yeah. Thanks, and there'll be more bills coming in that area as well. Further member discussion? Closing comments, Representative. Oh, sorry, go ahead, Representative Inkin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Novotny, for bringing this forward. I'm a huge proponent of scenario-driven training. I think it's not only essential to making sure we have the most equipped and efficient officers on the streets protecting us, serving us, but it also allows us as a committee to kind of humanize somebody who's wearing a bulletproof vest, somebody who goes to work and worries about things that I've never had to worry about. So I really appreciate you bringing this forward. I just had one quick question. We're shifting the cost to state funding. And I'm just curious as to why we see that's the best way of doing this.
Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Representative Engen. Typically, use of force training is done through the department. I wanted to eliminate all the obstacles from departments participating in this. I go back to my first use of force training was in Hutchinson, Minnesota. It's almost a two-hour drive, and it was simpler for my sheriff to pay me 2 hours driving each day of overtime, so 4 hours overtime each day, than it was to get approval from the county board for overnight lodging. So we don't want any obstacles. We figure we can get about 90% of the law enforcement officers in the state are within an hour drive of the skills training programs or a school spread throughout the state, and that will encourage the schools to have multiple agencies showing up at the same time, signing up for the program, and being covered without a department having to worry about getting approval for the money.
Representative Ingen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's perfect. Thank you, Representative Novotny. I couldn't be in more support of this.
Closing comments, Representative Novotny.
I feel this situation, this training, if approved, will make a difference. It'll solve or at least help eliminate some of the situations that we might come upon with these blocks of instructions on the de-escalation and post-traumatic stress and and bias motivation. That's part of the training too. It will make a difference. I thank you for hearing the bill, and you know, keep in mind, if we eliminate one critical incident, you won't know about it because it's been eliminated, but we're all going to be better for that. And I just think that this will help gentlemen like these that came down to help Minnesota law enforcement get to that next level, take that next step of professionalism that I think we need to take, and I hope the members of this committee will help me work on as the session goes forward.
Thank you, and we do appreciate the testifiers being here today. Thank you. Representative Novotny renews the motion that House File 2253 as amended be re-referred to the Committee on Higher Education, Finance, and Policy. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. Thank you, everybody, for the good discussion we had today. And with that, this meeting is adjourned.